Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with author and physician-patient advocate, Dr. Stephen Cusin, about his book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. Not your doctor will see you now, but your patient will see you now.
Yeah, it really turns a twist on...
Yeah, provocative, and I think it's a provocative discussion about patient empowerment.
I am excited to have that conversation, but first we've got some good research that matters about thyroid and heart problems, about berries and memory loss.
About bullying and DNA changes.
Mm-hmm. And about tabloid magazine coverage of dating abuse.
Ooh, we're getting into some tabloid coverage. Mm. Who would have thought?
So
Let's
exciting.
Let's jump right in here, though, about hyper and hypothyroidism, the thyroid-stimulating hormone being too much or too little, but not overtly, but what's called subclinically.
So this is a new report suggesting that higher than normal, I'll talk about that first, is linked to a greater risk of heart disease, including irregular heartbeats. So they looked at previous trials, including over 50,000 older adults and people whose hormone tests showed slight hyperthyroidism, meaning overactive thyroidism, and that found that they were 29% more likely to die of heart disease over the next 9 years than those who had normal thyroid function.
Yeah, and that study was in the Archives of Internal Medicine. And at the same time, another study was published that looked at the other side about those who had hypothyroidism, again, just below the normal level. And they found among 5,000 people that were followed for 8 years that 7% of those who were not treated for this little bit low thyroid condition developed heart disease, compared to only 4% of those who developed heart disease. So I guess the bottom line, Christy, is do a slightly high thyroid or slightly low thyroid both contribute to heart disease?
And they may. I mean, certainly this suggests that there is a link between the heart and the thyroid, but it's hard to know what is causing what, and it doesn't prove that treating thyroid for some of these real borderline cases is necessarily going to lead to a reduction in this, but it suggests the link.
Right, and I think it kind of suggests to me that if we found someone who was a little bit anemic, we would do an investigation. If their blood mm-hmm. counts were low, if we found their potassium is low, we probably would treat it. And perhaps maybe we've been lulled a little bit into sleeping, just a little bit. That's just my own personal opinion, that maybe I'm just like assuming that just a little bit low thyroid or just a little bit high thyroid, it's okay. And maybe I'm not right.
Yeah, maybe you're not. And I think this, for patients out there, if you've had a slightly abnormal TSH or that thyroid stimulating hormone screening test, I would encourage your doctor to recheck that and follow it up with a full panel to try to understand exactly what's going on and ask the question, is this related to developing heart disease?
Good suggestion. Let's talk about our next research that matters about berries, strawberries and blueberries, and its links with aging and memory.
I mean, this really just makes me want to go out and have a big bowl of strawberries. This was a study looking at 16,000 women who were taking part in that nurses' health study that we've talked a lot about, following their diet since 1980.
And they actually followed them every 2 years in three different telephone interviews to see their memory changes and how well they could perform on several common memory tests, and then to see to what extent this related to the amount of blueberries and strawberries, which are high in these protectant, potentially, chemicals called flavonoids.
And they found that the women who ate the most blueberries and strawberries, compared to those who had the fewest, had the most The ones who ate the most had a slower rate of developing memory problems.
Yeah, it was like it was pretty impressive. They were like 2.5 years of aging, the difference between those who ate more and those who didn't. And they even controlled for those who got more exercise and income levels. And I was like, wow, this is impressive. This was in the Annals of Neurology and big research all over the country. And the question is, we were saying last week, a couple weeks ago, Chris, you were talking about apples and pears, oh my, about diabetes.
Blueberries, apples, and pears, oh my.
Right. Do we need to say blueberries, strawberries, apples, and pears, oh my, and oh my, my? It gets a mouthful.
It's funny. Well, since we did that show, I've been bringing home more blueberries and strawberries for my kids, but I probably need to eat some myself.
Yeah, and you don't need a whole lot here. That's one of the take-home messages. I think it was like a half of a cup two or three times a week. So I think this is a good idea. Probably can't get it from the juice, but from the fresh strawberries and blueberries. Can there be anything bad here?
Yeah, really not a lot of downside to this.
Okay. Let's talk about our next research that unfortunately may be a downside.
Yeah, it really may be. This is about youth violence, about kids who are exposed to bullying, that they may age faster.
Yeah, this is research that was in this journal called Molecular Psychiatry. I didn't know there was such a journal, but we are following it now. And it really looked at children, twins, actually, and those who were exposed to different levels of violence as children, and then what actually happened to their DNA as potentially as a result of this violence compared to those that didn't. And there were changes.
The children who were exposed to cumulative violence showed a faster shortening of this part of DNA called the telomere.
T-E-L-O-M-E-R-E.
And between the ages of 5 and 10, children who had more cumulative violence had a shorter part of their DNA.
Which really suggests that exposure to trauma really does, in fact, impact your DNA. And the environment in how it influences our DNA. It's not just, oh, we're born with certain genetic susceptibilities that may be there, but we can actually, the experiences matter. And I guess what's upsetting for me, Christy, is, look, is this reversible? So there's accelerated aging from this exposure to violence. Is it reversible? But it also suggests that we should do everything we can to prevent exposure to violence, because that's not good.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't tell us whether or not it's reversible. You would certainly hope so. But early intervention and safe homes for our children are obviously very, very important.
Speaking of safety, let's our last research that matters looks at the whole question of the exposure of this Rihanna and Chris Brown, the sexual violence, the domestic violence, the abuse that Rihanna experienced from Chris Brown, and the tabloids covering of this. And what do we find from how they reviewed the coverage of this domestic violence situation?
This is really sad. I mean, we know dating abuse is a really big problem among teenagers. Huge consequences. 1 in 10 high school students in our country say they've been hit or slapped or abused. So this is a big deal. And yet, as they look at the content and the analysis of the way the media framed this particular incident, it didn't really put it in. I was not proud of this.
No, they reviewed 48 articles. This was in the Journal of Health Communication after the abuse, and they looked at how the media portrayed it. And in only 40% of the time was the frame of that, how the media produced it, really of abuse that was condemned. The majority of the time, there were other very mixed messages that were not a firm message that abuse is wrong and dispel the myths about it. And so we really have to focus on really dismissing those myths.
Well, and a lot of these tabloids, they blame the victim. They question if it was really abuse. They sort of romanticize and sexualize the abuse. And, I mean, these are sending really confusing messages to our young people.
Now, our message is clear today. Our take-home message is that was wrong and domestic violence is wrong and needs to stop. That's clear on our show.
Okay, well, that's all we'll have time for today on Research That Matters. But we've talked a little bit about dating abuse, and we should do a whole show on that, Adam.
Yep. And our messages about hypo or hyperthyroidism, about bullying and DNA changes.
About berries maybe slowing memory loss. Eat your strawberries and blueberries.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Cusin about his book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I are going to talk with author and physician-patient advocate Dr. Stephen Cusin about his book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now.
Welcome, Dr. Cusin, to Your Health.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, I think Christy and I, when we have guests on that have written books, we frequently want to know their story. What got them interested in writing a book? And you being a gastroenterologist that was in practice for a long time, I could understand that you would have lots of insights on patients and their perspectives. But when I started reading your introduction, I was really shocked. Tell us a little bit how you decided to write this book.
My best insights occurred not from being a physician. They occurred by being a patient. When 6 years ago, I was involved in a motor vehicle accident and was hospitalized, many people asked me, some in a rather snide way, about what's it like being on the other side of the bedpost? What's it like to be in bed rather than standing over it? What's it like for a doctor to be a patient? And it occurred to me when I was a patient that my decisions were taken with great seriousness. My impressions were given great concern. All my interests were seen to, my comfort, my dignity. I knew all my providers. I knew their names. I knew their husbands, their wives, their lives. I knew their strengths and weaknesses. And so in many ways, I wasn't at all like a patient. And so I realized that how disparate my care was from those around me, and decided that you don't have to be a doctor to be treated like one, and therefore wrote the book with that in mind, the idea of patients can learn lessons on how to navigate the system in a way that their needs and their objectives and their dignity and their opinions are seen to with great care.
Yeah, that's really powerful. But if it's okay, I'd like to just read one or two sentences that you wrote in the introduction, because I think that that description really lets us, our listeners, know a little bit about you. But the seriousness of the accident, you said that now it was your turn to lie on a stretcher in the emergency room, and you'd laid there with a false spiritual fill-up empowered by morphing and lingering shock, the first patient-oriented perspective for you on hospital life. Lying down, strung out, looking up and counting. That's really scary.
Well, you know, I've made tens of thousands of vertical entries into the hospital, but it was that one horizontal entrance that made the difference in my life. It changed the kind of doctor I became, and it changed my perspective on a variety of cultural and even political things. Being a patient is a profoundly mind and life-changing experience, and it's one that in a doctor has an extra depth that I wanted to be able to offer to those who read the book.
It hits me as an educator, as a teacher of doctors, what a powerful teaching moment that is. And I know we want to get to some of the lessons that you have to teach our listeners, but I wonder if that's made you reflect at all on how we're training doctors and if there's a way to teach people more of that horizontal perspective.
Oh, you know, medical training devotes about 1 to 2% of its bulk to medical ethics, decision-making, decisional conflict, and patient-oriented issues. The chapter on empathy in my book talks about the fact that medical training is, by definition and its goal, is oriented to dehumanization and desensitization of these physician candidates. It's no surprise, then, that people who are in medical training are subject to anxiety and depression and suicidal thoughts, which has been documented throughout the literature. Medical training focuses on the science. It has a huge curriculum to give out in a very brief period of time. and it's not fulfilling the goals that are needed in everyday practice.
You know, in that chapter on empathy, and I know I also want to come to, we'll get to the title of the book, which is really kind of pejorative and jarring at the same time, and I know there's a reason for it, but in that chapter on empathy, you talk about the value for patients to schmooze with their doctors. Now, I know what that Yiddish word schmooze mean, and it's not a bad word. Explain what that word means, and how does it happen, and why is it good?
It's important to get within a doctor's circle of empathy, because doctors, number one, don't have time for it. Number two, can't really use it, because we spend so much of our time hurting our patients in a way that's therapeutic, whether it's needles or scalpels or toxic medications, that we don't and can't feel the patient's pain all the time. But patients should be able to somehow find a portal into a doctor's circle of empathy by stressing those things that make them similar to their doctors, because the root of empathy goes back in evolutionary times to tribes and relationship within tribes.
So how do they do that?
To get into the doctor tribe. And how to do that is showing some economic parity, common interests, common reading materials, common organizations, neighborhoods, something to pierce that armor that we all put up in front of patients as a way to help us take care of them.
Well, it's an interesting paradigm, because we in family medicine spend a lot of time teaching our doctors to think of our patients in the context of their family, in the context of their social and their home environment. But this really empowers the patient to think about ways to connect with their doctor and think about that, how they can frame it to connect with them. And I like it goes both ways, I would say, but it is empowering of thinking of something you can do to try to make that connection.
Yeah, the whole idea of shared decision-making, which is what I'm doing now. Patients are supported to play, are supposed to play a key role as co-producers of health and managers of their own health care, not even just partners, but managers. Because I think Clemenceau said it, war is too important to be left to the generals. I think that sometimes medicine is too important to be left to the doctor.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Kusin, author of a new book called Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. And Dr. Kusin, in your book, you actually have lots of chapters about different aspects of the medical encounter. And I wonder if one of them you could comment on, which is your experience being in the hospital. You talk about this, the hospitalist, those who are increasingly in many communities charged with caring for patients, no longer the primary care doctor or the private doctor who followed the patient, but these hospitalists who only care for it. And it sounds like you have some worries and some recommendations. Could you tell us about that?
The worries are, to a patient, landing up in a hospital is like being washed up on a foreign shore. And one stable characteristic of hospital care that used to be part of medicine was at least you'd be taken care of by a doctor who you knew and who knew you and whose providence, where they came from, how smart they are, was already the object of research. And yet when you need someone who knows you and who you know and who you can trust the most, because being in a hospital today means you're going to be terribly sick, you're not going to have that resource, because hospitalists are assigned to you. You don't know where they came from. They don't know where you came from. When you leave, they don't know or particularly are seem interested in where you're going, because so many of the discharge summaries are incomplete and the care is so disjointed. So I have a real worry about being under the care of hospitalists. This doesn't in any way mean anything about any individual hospitalist physician.
Well, there,
but it's a bad time to meet a stranger.
There are still models and still doctors out there, primary care doctors, who do see their patients in the hospital. But for patients out there, and increasingly, you know, huge numbers of patients who don't have that, what do you recommend to help navigate that or help make that connection in a way that they can still receive good care in the hospital?
Well, one thing is to keep your own physician in the loop. A lot of doctors don't even know their patients are in the hospital. So the first thing is a phone call to the office and said, guess what? I'm in the hospital and I'd like you to come by.
Hmm.
Or at least know who my hospitalist is and understand that you should have access to my records. Tell the hospitalist. Two, whenever there's a dictation or a lab result, simply to get a copy to the primary care physician so they can at least know what's going on. And it's important to acknowledge to the hospitalist that although you welcome them into your care, you're also aware and feel somewhat exposed by the weaknesses in the hospitalist movement, in that you don't know them and they don't know you. And because of that, you may be asking questions in a little bit more pointed fashion, and to take no offense with that. But the whole idea is they're strangers after all, and I don't think any physician should let their license be an entitlement to care, much less a stranger.
Well, Dr. Cusin, we do need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking about your book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with author and physician patient advocate Dr. Stephen Cusin about his new book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. And I know, Dr. Cusin, you have some experiences in the emergency room and some recommendations. And Christy, you had a question specifically about the emergency room.
Well, I just I spend a lot of time. My husband's an emergency physician, and we spend a lot of time talking to friends and people who call us about wait times, about how to navigate triage, about which ER to go to. And I was struck by the recommendations you have in your book. What do you think are the most important features of an emergency room or recommendations for patients to navigate that?
Emergency rooms overall have gotten a C-minus grade as to the speed of care and the efficiency of care and the cost of care. I think when patients make a decision as to which emergency room they go to, they shouldn't use the path of least resistance. In other words, most people prioritize convenience. The closest emergency room is their emergency room. But the difference between hospitals and the difference between emergency rooms, they're brands, just like flat-screen TVs. And yet people are such poor medical consumers and such discriminating retail consumers that they just lump all hospitals together. I think a trauma-level hospital, a trauma-level 1 or 2, really helps put a leg up. In other words, when you are going to a trauma-level 1 or a trauma-level 2 hospital, you know that there's 24-hour staffing by radiology and neurosurgery and surgery and other specialties that are, of course, important during trauma. The wait time is something that can always be looked into, if not on a billboard on the way in when the hospital is advertising its wait times, which are, by the way, not usually accurate. But there are ways of maximizing your the drama of being ill without over-dramatizing it so your priority status is maximized rather than minimized. There's a way of telling your story.
Give an example of that.
It's like you give the punchline first. It's you, when you go into the emergency room, you don't say, you know, a couple of hours ago I was having some pain around the middle of my chest, and boy, you should have seen me, I was in so much pain. You don't want to do that. You want to go in and you don't want to, we just want to give them the punchline. I have chest pain. And that's, let them ask you questions about the chest pain rather than doing your own internal triage. Chest pain is chest pain. Let them ask you the questions. Things like that.
You don't want to minimize your own experience before you've experienced it.
Exactly. You've just put yourself way down on the list. You know, when you're waiting for the ambulance or you become medically sophisticated as a function of the ongoing process of informing yourself, you'll learn which things that can be honestly stated. You don't want to say things that aren't true. You'll end up getting care you don't need or don't want. But you'll know that when you have a headache, if you're going to the emergency room, you're not going anywhere very fast unless you say, this is the worst headache of my life, and it's on the right side of my head, and I've never had headaches before. Now, if that's the case, that's what you should say, because that maximizes the presentation you're making. And so it's not a bad idea to understand what makes a headache important. Now, certainly, if it's not true, you don't want to say it, because then you're going to get things you don't need.
You know, speaking of the emergency room, I had a colleague who was in an emergency room for a skin rash at one time, and the doctor treated them with kind of disdain, and they came to me about kind of what to do about that. And you talk in your book about, you know, if you've been dissed, I assume that may be another Yiddish word, but tell us about how you recommend when a patient experiences perhaps a provider talking to them in less than friendly ways, maybe even hostile ways, perceived that way.
Is the use of inappropriate humor to minimize a patient's problems. There's the use of minimizing problems by saying you're such a worrier. There's the idea that a problem that's important to you may not be important to the provider. You know, it's the chronic nagging issues that are most important to patients, and yet those are the things that fly under the radar for most physicians, especially given the limited amount of time we have to see our patients. And so there's a certain respect. I believe that, frankly, I've always called my patients by their last name, and I'd write them down phonetically so I would not mispronounce them, which is a sign of disrespect. And if the patient wished to be called by their first name, then I would invite them back to call me by my first name. That disconnect of Dr. This versus, you know, not even Robert, Bob or Bobby or hey, pal. These things are not acceptable, and inappropriate humor is not acceptable. A doctor's style, the way that he or she presents themselves to the patient, there's certain minimums of style. You know, the first thing we're supposed to do is do no harm. The second injunction that I believe should be in play is do not alarm. Do not alarm by your attitude. Do not alarm by your presentation, of your physical presentation, your clothing, and your attitude. So do no harm and do not alarm. And if your patient, and if you're a doctor and you do those things that enhance the trust that should be part of the equation, patient's going to understand it, appreciate it, compliance will be better as well.
Well, I know, Dr. Kusin, when we first had you on the air, before we actually officially came on the air, we, Christy and I, said that we would call you Dr. Kusin. Your first thing you told us is, call me Stephen. And we haven't done that, but you obviously practice what it is you're preaching. And I know that that actually was established some trust, I think, between us. And we appreciate that and appreciate that recommendation.
And the funny thing is, it takes so little effort to do those very little but important things to let our patients know that we care about them. Even if it just means putting in the calendar their birth dates or remembering something they told you from the last visit. Or sending a get well card if they cancel an appointment because they're not feeling well. Such little things mean a lot, and it's so rare that patients should value it when they experience it.
Well, and those are the things that, for many doctors, are the things that are renewing for us, of remembering why we went into this particular career path and why we're spending our time taking care of our patients is that human connection. One of the things you write about a little bit is recommendations for how to choose a doctor. And we just recently got a question on our house call segment about, I moved back to town, I got all these specialists, but how do I find a really good primary care doctor? What kind of recommendations do you have to guide people in this?
Well, I've used three criteria: brains, communication, and empathy. Now, the book goes into some detail on how you can make your doctor a better communicator. We've discussed, and the book discusses, how you can make your doctor more empathic. But the point that's the most important is you can't make your doctor smarter. And yet, brains, at the end of the day, is the sole entitlement that's necessary and sufficient when you're receiving care. And the way that I've formulated that is simply finding out where your doctor went to college, where your doctor went to medical school, where your doctor did their training. And, you know, for you guys down at UNC, that's number two in the country for primary care education. And so you're at a wonderful place, and people who are training, I think you're probably noting, are very bright people versus the other 150 hospitals, especially if you're at the 150th hospital. And so a doctor who is able to get through to a great college and then to a great medical school and then to a great training hospital, the brains come along for the trip. And you can find out on U.S. News and World Report, it's as good as any place and better than most, where the colleges rank and where the medical schools rank and where hospitals rank. If your doctor is in a top hospital and rates high right across the board, I think brains become something that you can assume to be in place and then start prioritizing the other factors.
Well, we appreciate you sharing that little tidbit about our family medicine residency program and department. We do work hard, and we know other doctors work hard. I think in our final kind of two questions, one has to do with what you're doing now. because I think it's interesting for our listeners. But the other has to do with the title of the book and the picture on the front for our listeners, and we're going to put a picture on our website. But the title is Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now, but there's also a subtitle, which is Gaining the Upper Hand, and you have a patient's hand actually taking the doctor's pulse. Tell us about the picture and the title, and then tell us what you're doing now.
The whole idea of the cover of the book is doing a 180 on common wisdom. It's not directed to patients saying, the doctor will see you now. It's the idea that, doctor, your patient is sufficiently entitled and empowered that they are going to manage aspects of this transaction. And relevant to my idea that patients should have access to unbiased, accurate, evidence-based, and physician-grade material, then patients become managers of their own care, and they should be taking the pulses of their physicians rather than the opposite, or at least in conjunction. So patients should examine their doctors as rigorously as we examine them. And so it's just a 180 on the conventional wisdom of who's calling the shots. And that's what I'm doing now in the Shared Decision Center. Shared decision-making is very common in Europe and Canada, but it's almost non-existent here, at least for now, in the United States. And the tenet of shared decision-making is no decision is valid until it's been run through the filters of the patient's priorities, risk tolerance, and values. And although it may be evidence-based, it doesn't have to be, because evidence-based medicine is sometimes based on population statistics. And those, although important, don't address themselves always to what's the inherent throbbingness and messiness of life. And that can only be determined by understanding a patient's values and seeing where they stand, and then applying the evidence where it's possible. And that's what I do here in this Shared Decision Center.
Well, Dr. Cusin, we certainly appreciate your very patient-centered approach, both to writing the book and into shared decision-making, of really thinking about that individual's needs and their need to learn to navigate the system. So thank you for taking some time with us and for your efforts to really make this enterprise patient-centered.
Well, it's my pleasure to have been with you folks.
And thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Adam.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Christy.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For a House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about patient health questions and concerns. Hopefully that will be empowering to our patients.
Yeah, if you have a question you'd like for us to address, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu or put it on our app or on our blog at yourhealthradio.org.
And we have some questions today about rashes and about blood sugar levels.
And about dental implants, and about employee health programs and something called the CRP.
Which we'll find out what it is in just a minute.
That's right. Let's take our first house call question.
I have a rash that keeps showing up on my left wrist on the inside. It's itchy and red and ugly. I'm not sure where it's coming from. Any suggestions?
Okay, Christy. I've got my left arm up now, and I'm looking on my left wrist,
and I'm trying to envision.
You see a watch, yes, but I'm trying to envision here. We got an itchy red, which by definition would be ugly on me, and certainly on a lot of wrist I can see there. So the question is, what are the different possibilities? This is really hard.
Yeah, without seeing it or knowing more, I would want to know, is that where you wear your wrist? I'm looking at you, Adam, and you've got that wrist on your left
hand.
That you have a wrist on your
left
wrist.
Hand.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You have a watch, excuse me, everyone, on your left wrist. And many people are allergic to nickel, which can be in watches. I'd wonder if you look at your pants buckle if you wear jeans.
I'm not going to do that right now,
no,
Christy.
Please don't. I'm not saying you. I'm saying our listener. Please, you could check and see if other places where metal rubs against your skin, if you
That's
have a little
really
rash
good
there.
Suggestion. Good suggestion. And the other thing sometimes is people get what's called eczema, or that dry, itchy, red skin. And that kind of shows up at the same place. And when you itch it and scratch it and scratch it and itch it, it starts getting red and thickened. And then you kind of have a little bit of a chronic problem that can kind of come and go. So this is one of those things that would be great to take a picture and or come see your primary care doctor or your dermatologist.
I think that's good. Let's take our next house call question.
I see they sell blood sugar machines at the drugstore, and I wonder if I should have one to check my sugar when I get sick. I do not have diabetes, but is this something that would be helpful for me to check at home to be sure I'm not getting it?
You know, I want to compliment you for thinking about taking care of your health. And the fact that you're interested in checking and knowing how your body is doing, even though you don't have diabetes, we may give you a different answer on this, but I do think that the inclination to invest in your health is a good one. I want to compliment that.
That was a really positive thing, Christy. I like that, actually, because some of my initial thoughts maybe weren't quite as, I'm thinking that, you know, there's lots of machines in drugstores and, you know, people worry about lots of things. And diabetes, a lot of times people worry about it, but you say you really don't have risk factors for it. You're not overweight. You don't really have a family history of diabetes. Or even if you did, it's in someone who is overweight and you're not. So we kind of discount that. But I think you're right on target that this is a legitimate concern, even though I wouldn't recommend you go out and buy the machine.
Right. Exactly. So if you don't have diabetes, then this is not going to be very helpful information for you. So if you've had your regular screening with your doctor and you know you don't have diabetes, then checking your blood sugar frequently or really checking it at all is not going to give you helpful information, and it might hurt.
And even a lot of people who think they even have low blood sugar, we don't necessarily recommend getting if you was diagnosed with hypoglycemia or diagnosed with hyperglycemia. But in the absence of it, in the absence of significant risk factors for that, then perhaps we should have you just continue having a healthy lifestyle. And we hope that you are having a healthy lifestyle and be reassured.
I would focus on keeping a healthy weight and exercise.
Amen.
Let's take our next house call question.
I had a dental implant last week. It hurts deep inside my mouth, but there's no tenderness around the gums. Today, I started feeling achy all over and a little bit nauseated. I don't have a high fever, but I do feel like I have a low-grade one. Could that be due to an infection in my mouth? Do I call the dentist or the doctor?
This sounds difficult. I do have lots of empathy for anyone who has dental procedures done, because I know that it's a lot of times painful, and a lot of us don't like that.
Well, and it does hurt. And so it's hard to know. Is that hurt mean that there's an infection, or does the hurt mean just my body's getting used to it? And in your case, you've started feeling a little bit sick. And so that could be that you happen to get a virus by picking up a bug at, you know, a little time after you had the dental implant, but they could be related.
Yeah, sometimes I get a little worried when you have A happening and then B happening, and A and B were real close to each other. Mm-hmm. Could they be related? I mean, they may not be. It could be, you know, a total coincidence that you happen to get in your car and someone hit you, but it could be that you were kind of going somewhere where there's something happening. And so in this particular case, you wonder, could there be an infection from the procedure? Or sometimes when you have dental procedures, there's bacteria that goes into the bloodstream called bacteremia, bacteria in the bloodstream. That could have happened, and you might feel achy and even have something serious.
Whether to call your dentist or your doctor, I would call whichever one you can get in touch with first. That's my practical advice.
If you tell us your dentist, we'll put that number on the line.
That's right. But I do think seeing your primary care doctor, sometimes they can put more together the medical illness in relation to the dental work. But I'd say call both.
Yep. And speaking
better.
Of calling, let's hear our very last house call.
My employee health program at work does a big screening process that includes a whole bunch of tests. The report is confusing to me. One test that was a little high is the CRP that says I might be at higher risk for heart disease. Can you tell me more about this? Should I be worried?
This is an important question about an important topic that we have heard a lot more about over the last 2 years, which is this relationship between the CRP or C-reactive protein and whole body inflammation in heart disease.
What we know about the CRP or C-reactive protein is that it is a marker of inflammation, and that there is an association and a link with heart disease and having high levels of inflammation and CRP in your body.
But should you be worried about it? Most people in our practice who have elevated CRP have other risk factors for heart disease. And so I don't know if you should be any more worried about it than you would about your other risk factors if you don't exercise or if you're obese or if you have elevated cholesterol levels or smoke. These are the things that we know you can do something about and change. We don't really know how you can change your CRP level.
Well, and none of the organizations that we really trust are recommending broad testing of the CRP because there's not very much we can do about it. And the information is not all that helpful. What I would say to you is don't worry, but exercise, keep a healthy weight, make sure your blood pressure is well controlled, your cholesterol is well controlled, those things that you can make a difference on, and hope for the best.
Amen to that too, Christy. Well, right. That's going to conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank you for joining us. We've had a chance to talk about this C-reactive protein.
To talk about dental implants and illness.
About good health, but not necessarily buying devices if you don't really have the risk factors.
And a little bit about a mystery rash on the wrist.
The left wrist.
The left wrist.
Okay. Well, we're going to hopefully we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can certainly go to yourhealth@unc.edu and go to our health application online by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Stephen Cusin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.